child. It's just one that we're happy.
Oh, no.
Yet. Dead wrong.
The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome. We are going to open up Senate Bill 64A because, no, we are not opening Senate Bill 64A. We are opening Senate Bill 48A, and I would invite up Senator Przanski, please. A public hearing on Senate Bill 48A.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, Senate District 4, which includes parts of Blaine and Douglas County. Thank you very much for letting me be here today and give some testimony on Senate Bill 48. And particularly what I will be addressing is kind of an overview of how 48 evolved, where it start, how I got involved with it, and two sets of amendments that I had, one drafted and then the what has now, been another revolution as to another set of amendments, which I believe you have, the Dash 7s. So just very briefly, Senate Bill 48 was assigned to the Senate Judiciary Committee. That is how I first came aware of it. And reviewing the information that was in that bill and discussing the different components as to that bill, it came to my attention that there was a what I would consider a loophole in the perspective of where a teacher has been alleged of involved in some type of inappropriate conduct, and that there was not a mechanism the mechanisms that were in place to deal with that before the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission did not seem to fulfill what I believe the intent of this legislature has been in the past. Specifically, that if an individual is accused of some type of, and I will use the term, sexual misconduct involving a student, the bottom line is that the board does in fact have the authority to take action regarding that individual through a hearing process, and that they use the standard or the burden of proof by preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not, a simple type of test. The individual could be found to be engaged in that conduct, and even though they are not, taken through a criminal process and convicted, they can in fact be, delicensed and be suspended from the profession. Current law does allow them after, I believe it is 10 years, to be able to reapply if they choose to do so, and they can in fact be relicensed in the state of Oregon. Upon learning that and knowing of the type of offenses that are covered within the sexual conduct, I and others within the committee felt that we needed to have a stronger message for those who might be considering being engaged in that type of conduct, that if they are in fact found to be engaged in that conduct, either if they were convicted through a criminal case or if they have a civil process with a hearing before the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, that they would not only lose their license from that conduct, they would not be allowed to reapply in the future for reacceptance to be a teacher in this state. The purpose and the reason I think this is important is that I believe that as in the profession that I am a part of as an attorney, that it's important for our organizations and our professions to self-police ourselves. This is one way that we can actually gain greater trust within the general public, knowing that if a person is in fact found to be involved in that type of conduct, that we do not have to worry that in 10 years or a greater length of time that they are going to be able to find themselves in the classroom again and potentially subjecting another child to that type of conduct. That is the purpose of it, and what I will do is very briefly review with you the Dash 7s. Starting on page 2, line 26, this is section 1-6 small a, and this one here is basically disclosure of records. The purpose for this section is that if a person is in fact found to be one convicted of this type of crime, and or if they were engaged in this determined by the commission to be engaged in this type of conduct, and the conduct is basically limited to having sexual contact and or conduct, I should say, because it's much broader than just contact, with a student that is in grade 12 or below, that they would, whatever disposition is done through the commission could in fact be disclosed to someone that was making an inquiry as to whether or not that person has been involved in some type of conduct that would be inappropriate for them to continue to teach. The reason that's important is because if a teacher leaves the state after they have been de-licensed, I believe it's important for us not to, let's say, pass that person along to another state to allow that person to basically reoffend in another state. And this is a means of, through our record disclosure, that if they seek to be a teacher in another state, that other state would be able to obtain and access those records. Under Section 2 of the bill, this is on page 4, starting on line 4, sub 1, sub B. This is an area regarding the reporting requirements. And when I say reporting requirements, the difference from this, from the first section, this is where a co-worker, an employee at the school, has reason to believe that a child has been sexually, sexual contact has, or conduct has occurred regarding a child that's within the school, and another school employee is the accused perpetrator. They have a duty to disclose that to their employment, to the board, or to the other supervisors within the school, so there can be an appropriate steps taken by that school board and school district. Under Section 2, sub 3, or number 3, sub A, which is line, would be on page 4, starting on line 13. This basically sets up the procedure that it will be used where there is a conviction or an allegation of misconduct. And I'll not go through any detail on that, but then on page 7, under section 4.2b, that is an area where that includes the employee that has been found to be engaged in the in this type of conduct would in fact be denied relicensing. That starts on, again, on page 7, line 29. There is another section under section 5, sub 2. This deals with what I would loosely define as student teachers. As you probably are aware, there are a number of individuals who, when they're going through the university system, that are seeking to be certified as teachers. They do, in fact, go through a student teaching program at various school districts, and this is a process that says what the sanctions can be by the commission regarding a person in that capacity that has been found to be convicted or involved in this type of conduct. The last two pieces that that make up this dash 7 is the operative dates for when it would go into effect, as well as an emergency clause. The last thing that dash 7 does is, because there's another bill that's in the process, I believe it is SB 47, that this bill has resolution conflicts for the two components of the bills that are in conflict. Madam Chair, that's my testimony.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee for Senator Brzezinski? Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe it's a concern because it lists as grade 12. So therefore, it reduces, it does away with the age requirement of 18 and a person being of normal age. So my concern is, I'm a young person who just got out of college. I've gotten married. I'm a teacher. My wife didn't graduate from high school. She's 18 or 19 years old. I get a job, and I think, you know, it'd be great to have a diploma. The school says that they can have a diploma, and they can come back to school. So she goes and re-enters. She's now in 12th grade. She's having activities with me as her husband that would be, under this bill, not appropriate. Somebody turns it in, says there's a problem. What happens now?
Well, I would assume, first of all, knowing that she, quote-unquote, has been emancipated through the marriage, and if that occurred even before 18, that the commission would look at that and not go forward. Now, clearly, if Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, if you believe that we need to have that type of amendment to say that you have something, that's fine.
Okay.
Here's what we're trying to do. When the bill first started out, it basically said age 18. There are, in fact, young people who are age 18 or older that are within our system. I believe that there's a trust here and a bond that is established, and I believe that a person in the profession of teaching or whatever profession, that they have that type of supervisory overview and let's say not only protection but obligation to the youth even though they may be of age, that that type of conduct should not be occurring. That's why we limited it and moved it back to the point of someone being within the K-12 system and not used an age as a division as to when the conduct would be appropriate. If I could follow, I mean, if we did it the other way, then you could, in fact, have that same young teacher having some type of sexual contact or conduct with a student that was 18 or 19 that was under their charge, and I don't believe that's what any of us would want.
Well, follow up.
Doesn't the TSPC have the authority and the school district right now to deal with that?
Madam Chair and Representative Roblin, they do have the authority to take action, as you are saying, as what I've alluded to. What currently is in the law, which I believe needs to be modified, is two things. Number one, there needs to be disclosure to anyone that's making a request to get that information, specifically other school districts that may be looking at employing this person in the future. The second is that I believe that there's a message to be sent by requiring that that person not be allowed to be reauthorized to teach in the schools within Oregon. Currently, my understanding is that after 10 years, they would, in fact, be able to reapply. And I just think that they've broken the trust with the general public by the conduct the first time, and I don't believe that, personally, that they should have a second chance to reoffend.
One last follow-up.
It has to do with a separate group. So do attorneys have the same kind of requirement that if there was a client and they took advantage of that relationship that they would lose their license to be a lawyer forever?
My understanding, it could go multiple ways. Number one, they can't, in fact, be disbarred.
I know that's true.
Right. And then at that point, they would have to, I believe that there is not anything that prohibits them from reapplying at this point. But I would hope that my profession would, in fact, take that in consideration.
And I personally can't tolerate the behavior, but I just want to, you know, not, we pile a lot of things in education at times that make me nervous.
Well, and Madam Chair and Representative Roblin, I understand that, but to me, the best way I guess I could put this in perspective is that we entrust individuals in their profession, and in this particular case, that we are giving them a charge to have a contact and control and supervisory obligations over a child of under age 18, for the most part. And to me, that's takes it to a different level than potentially a consenting adult who may not be in the best position to make good decisions. You can look at the bar disciplinary actions that have occurred, where there have in fact been sanctions entered, but for I believe there's a reason for a greater protection for a child that's within the K-12 system.
I appreciate that.
And I had a quick follow-up on the first question about the age. This changes it to grade 12, but in our K-12 system, we do have students who are no longer considered to be in age 12 but continue receiving services through the age of 21 in a public school system. They're not assigned to a grade, and these would tend to be profoundly disabled children. Would they be covered under this language, or might we need an adjustment to be sure that we are maintaining that trust with that population of students as well?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure how they are categorized or classified within the K-12 system when they reach that level within the system. I am familiar, based on constituents who are, in fact, have special needs children that are in school after age 18. I don't know if they have a special designation if the committee is so sees it fit to modify that. I personally would have no problem with that.
Thank you. Representative Innerman.
Thank you, Chair Gill, sir. This feels like deja vu. And one of the concerns I have is, having been in the system and knowing how children behave sometimes, how can I, as a teacher, be assured that this decision is going to be just, that it is in fact true, and that I have been afforded due process?
Madam Chair and Representative Van Orm, clearly the provisions that are in place do in fact require due process, a hearing, an opportunity to be heard. The conduct that we're looking at, I know these are a bunch of numbers, but let me just go through some of these, what we're talking about. We're talking about rape in the first, second, or third degree. We're talking about sex abuse in the first, second, or third degree. We're talking about sodomy.
Senator Pazinski, we have the list in your packet on the letterhead from the TSDC, right. But please continue.
I'm not familiar with what you have, but the reality is we're talking about very serious contact or conduct by an individual. And clearly these individuals within the current administrative rules have the ability to be represented and to be heard at the time of hearing. It does require the same standard that is currently within place, which is a preponderance of the evidence. And for this, and if they, the issue I have as a prosecutor, there are some times where you have evidence, but you don't have the evidence to get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. And the question I had when I saw this is, do we not need to have some other safeguard to actually protect the children? That safeguard is in place. The question is, what is the appropriate sanction? And, I mean, we may have to agree to disagree, but in my opinion, that if someone has done one of those type of actions that have taken advantage of a child that's in K-12, and most of those are going to be under the age of 18, I don't believe they should have the right to continue that profession in the future.
Follow-up. But how is it determined that this person has done that? Is it primarily through the hearing process, or is it through the court process, a criminal proceeding process, or is it simply a TSPC?
Madam Chair and Representative, it could be both. It could be, if it's a conviction, it definitely occurred through a criminal conviction through a court.
And that would be easy.
That would not only be easy, that would be what most people would consider would be a slam dunk, because that means that a jury of their peers heard the evidence and came up with beyond a reasonable doubt standard. The others are going to be at a civil process, and these would be administrative hearings that are conducted by the commission, and we have a complete body of law that deals with what is required through administrative hearings to ensure due process. What can happen and what has happened, from my understanding, is that sometimes individuals will actually resign from their position before they are convicted. So then the question is, what next? Do you have a opportunity to bring them through the process on administrative hearing? Yes, you do. Whether or not the commission does that, that's their prerogative. But if they do so, then the question is, what are the sanctions? And I've been told by individuals within the teaching profession, some people have actually resigned, moved to another state, and got relicensed, and there's been no notice to the other jurisdiction where they are now licensed to teach, and the sanction, let's say, and I would say the sanction that could have been imposed wasn't imposed here because they've left and fled the state.
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a couple questions, and I'll start with my husband and I have spent a lot of energy empowering our son's teacher and giving our son's teacher a lot of authority. And with authority comes responsibility. And so, in essence, I like several pieces of this. What I really want to focus on right now is those students that are 18 or over, so we don't have a crime. However, that said, I guess what I'm looking at is, what is the process? So we have two consenting adults, but we have a student and a teacher. What is the process under this bill that will now take place, and how does that differ from in the past? I'm trying to work through this to see where we're at, because a couple things that, and I'll just kind of give you a couple of my red flags here that pop up, is this list of crimes right here, and I'm an ex-police officer, and I've investigated probably the majority of these, and we're talking very fine nuances between these, as you well know. And so I'm interested in the abilities and the training TSPC has to adequately investigate what would otherwise be known as a crime. So walk me through that process a little bit, if you would, and under this bill and how it differs.
All right. Madam Chair and Representative Stringer, my understanding is there is actually a process that's used by the commission where a complaint has been alleged against an individual. They open a file. They do an investigation. I cannot tell you what the extent of that investigation is, who those individuals are, but what I do understand is they gather data information, they make a determination as to whether they believe they have enough to go forward. And then there is a process, from my understanding, where I don't know if I would say it was a finding or if it is basically a introduction as to starting the administrative hearing process, where the allegation is listed and the person responds to it, or they challenge it as a contested case type of process, the way I understand it, and it works at that level. It is not criminal. I cannot tell you what is the background of the investigator or investigators or the individuals that are would be currently sitting on in review of that, but I believe it's, lack of better terms, somewhat of a tribunal, and what I mean by that, more than one individual that's making that decision. I do not know whether or not it's just a single hearings officer or not. I'm not positive on, and maybe your administrator will be able to give you that information. But there goes through that process. There is the requirements as for any type of administrative hearing for that to be followed through certain rules and regs to give an individual an opportunity to be heard and to respond. And at some point, a decision is made. The burden is, as I mentioned, is at preponderance of evidence. I will tell this committee, I had talked to OEA after some issues were raised after we passed the bill out of the Senate, and one of the issues was that they wanted to, they thought that preponderance of evidence wasn't significant for the conduct that was being alleged. I had moved it and had intention to move it with the clear and convincing. Actually, I think we did move with the clear and convincing, but then there was a concern as to, I offered to do that, and then by the time I heard back, I had also heard from the commission itself that currently it is on the preponderance level, and their concern was that if it moved up to a clear and convincing, it could throw their whole system off. In other words, if you had a dual system for these particular type of charges or a conduct that's alleged, and you're going to use a measure of clear and convincing as compared to any other type of misconduct being a preponderance, that would cause them more difficulty. When I guess realized, understood fully, and appreciated that they currently have the preponderance standards and all their others, then I just went ahead and made the corrections to include what wasn't originally included, which are the more serious offenses, the first and second degrees, where the original amendment had just the third degree offenses, and that was an oversight when it was first drafted.
Follow up.
Thank you for that, and I just want to be very clear that I have absolutely zero tolerance for anybody that's in a classroom or around kids that does anything to kids, and I guess I'll stop that statement at that right there, because I have such little tolerance for it because of the way that we should be training our kids to give this person such authority in their lives. So that said, I want to qualify my statements with that. Talk to us a little bit about, because I certainly have an understanding of what preponderance of that level of preponderance of evidence is and that level of beyond a reasonable doubt is. And so talk to those if you could, or talk about those if you could, in very clear language, what the difference is between those two, preponderance of the of evidence, and what that really means. Because again, I'm going back to, do we have, and this is not a slam against TSPC, do we have people with, number one, enough training to investigate crimes, just minus the fact they're not 18, or they are 18, do they have enough training, and maybe more importantly, do they have enough experience?
Right.
And so talk to us about preponderance of the evidence, and then link those two pieces for us, please.
Okay, I'll do that. Madam Chair and Representative Springer, let me frame it this way. First of all, I don't have my jury instructions back to you, the instructions that you would hear if you were in a jury trial. But in a case that involves non-criminal activity, it is a preponderance of the evidence. That is more likely than not. As we described in law school, if you had scales of justice and they're sitting there and they're even, there's no difference between them. If I took a feather and put it on one side, that slight tipping would be enough to give a preponderance of the evidence. On the on the criminal side, there is beyond a reasonable doubt. The beyond a reasonable doubt is basically, I'm going to add a little this, and please don't hold me to the exact term, but it's basically to a moral certainty. It's not absolute. You don't have to have complete belief, but it's more certain. It is to the highest standard of having moral certainty as to the decision you make. Clear and convincing, which is the highest level that I am familiar with on the civil side, is what I would consider more certain than not. And it's kind of falls in between preponderance. It's definitely higher than that, but it's definitely less than beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, regarding whether or not the person or the individuals making these decisions have that training, our whole American judicial system is based on giving a jury of our peers, an opportunity to hear the evidence, get the instructions from the judge, and then that group of 6 to 12 people every day in this state and around this country make the same decision based on their experience and what they have heard. So I would say that the individuals that are sitting in these positions that would be making those type of decisions would, in fact, be able to make those decisions. Some are going to be tougher than others. Some are going to be very clear and bright line. Others may not be. But that's how our system's set up in the judicial process, and I believe it's a fair system. It's one that we've had since the beginning of our country, and it seems to be working still well today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, just so I kind of get the... This has probably already been answered, but under current law, TSPC can't do anything until there's been a criminal conviction under the background portion of this. Does 48 give TSPC preemption, or does it give them more authority than they have now in a situation like this, or is it just under the civil portion that they would proceed and then the courts could still step in after an investigation and take over and do the criminal conviction?
Madam Chair and Representative Huffman, I would disagree with the understanding that or at least the statement I heard. As my understanding, currently the commission does in fact have the authority to go forward based on engaged conduct standard. In other words, they do not have to wait until there's something that happens within the criminal side of the conduct being alleged, that they in themselves can do that without that. My understanding at this point, the standard that they use is the preponderance of evidence. Normally what you would see if you had, let's say, a criminal investigation going forward, the commission more than likely, like many other commissions or boards, would wait until the criminal side is completed and a determination is made there before they would move forward. And the reason for that is, I'd say, twofold. Number one, you have the ability, if you have a conviction come back, to automatically take the sanctions based on that conviction. Two, many commissions and other administrative type of process or proceedings are considered secondary where there is an active criminal investigation going on and that they do not want to, let's say, get in between that that discussion or that procedure. And if you can realize that you would have an individual who could be facing criminal charges who, if they were brought up in front of a administrative hearing, could and more than likely, if they were properly counseled, would take the Fifth Amendment if they had a criminal investigation going on because whatever they said in that proceeding could and more than likely would be used against them in the criminal matter by some type of admissions that occurred in that process. No, and my understanding is that this does not enhance their power to do what they can already do, the process and the procedure that's set forth. At least that's why I made the modifications I did. The only thing that this would do is state that where they in the past would allow an individual to reapply after being sanctioned through this process and being denied a license for a 10-year period, they would no longer be able to come back after the 10 years and apply to be able to come back into the profession in this state. And then the other part is the disclosure to other people outside of this outside of the process to maintain the insurance. And this has happened, and unfortunately, in many professions. We won't say anything bad. We just want to get you out of here. And then the next school district ends up dealing with a problem individual.
Thank you. And I know that you need to get back to testify in the Judiciary Committee. I think there's one last question from Representative Roblin.
And again, does the way the law is written, as I seem to see it written, the list of crimes here, when TSPC was doing the investigation, they would see this 18-year-old, if it's an 18-year-old, the same way they would see a underage person. So the crime would not be based on them being an adult. It would be based as if they were not an adult. Is that true? Because the crimes, who commits them is different based on their age. And right. So I want to understand, does this keep that 18-year-old as if they were not an adult until they get that up?
Yeah. Well, great. Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, let me answer the best I can from based on the understanding I have. First of all, there is a mixed opinions as to when the child is 18 or older as to what is permissible and what's on the conduct. If this is in a criminal matter, the prosecutor more than likely would look at this, and unless they could determine that somehow it was not consensual,
right,
they would not be prosecuting that case. On the civil side, in the sense of with the commission, I think it can go either way. And the reality, if we think about what we have to go through at the beginning of every session, that's the third component, that's sexual harassment. I believe that this child, the individual, even though they're 18, would in fact be able to bring an action against the teacher and the school district based on the power that person inherently has, meaning the teacher, over that student. That is why I chose to go with the Amendment 12 to 18, because I believe that's still in play, and this is a way that would somewhat give a bright line that says, even though this child may be of age, we still frown on this type of conduct.
Right. Okay. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And is there anyone else that wants to be heard on this bill today? They don't. So I'm going to hold over both the public hearing and the work session until we have a lot of bills on Friday already, don't we?
Nine.
So we're going to hold this over until Wednesday.
Should we bring up the guns?
Okay. So I'm going to, but I do want to hold this public hearing over, so we don't. Okay, I'm holding the public hearing over. Do I gavel?
We're closing it in.
And I'm opening a work session on this bill, which is Senate Bill 48, and holding the work session over until next Wednesday, May 27th. And before I close that work session, there is a -7 amendment. If you have not seen that, I know Kevin was working to send it out. I would like to hear from people about their concerns or support of the -7 amendments before the end of the week so that we can be prepared. Thursday is the last day that we're meeting. So if there are further amendments that are going to be requested to the bill, also if you can look at those and get those to me maybe tomorrow, that would be very helpful so we have some time to work together by the end of the week. So Kevin's just reminding us that Wednesday is our last meeting. But please feel free to communicate with us in writing before that time. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 48A. And is Senator Haft out in the hallway?
Yes.
While he is doing that, I'm going to... Wonderful. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 484A. Senator Haas, thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Mark Haas, Senate District 14. And
you know, not everybody in the Senate goes on and on and on and on. No, I mean that affectionately.
We'll be testing you.
I honestly don't want to pontificate on this bill. I know that you joined me in a joint hearing on year-round education in what seems like a lifetime ago. I remember that.
Doesn't it mean you want to introduce a bill on year-round legislators?
Yes, yeah, well, another issue, yeah. And so I know that you went through that, and we saw some research and heard some, I think...
Senator Hass, did you identify yourself for the record?
I did. Mark Hass.
Okay.
And so I think you're all familiar with this issue, and so, again, I won't go on and on. The area that's been of particular concern that you may have in your packets from that day from the Eco Northwest study is that... the learning loss that occurs over the long summer break. Studies have shown that summer vacation has a disproportionately negative impact on learning for students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds as well. And to make matters worse, this is apparently cumulative. The cost effectiveness of year-round education, that study, increasing learning time, may be an expensive proposition, but analysts have suggested that a 10% increase in school time would increase costs by approximately only 6%. So there was something of a bargain there, or at least a good value. So what this bill would do would, I think, lay the not even the foundation, but just the framework for allowing school districts to set up a summer school through either a tuition and scholarship combination, or the one that I'm particularly interested in pursuing, a pilot project where grants help pay for some exploration and some investigation into how well these may or may not work. I've been in talks with some of those grant writers from Chalk Board and Intel already about starting this up, and this would be a huge help to get that going. And I think more than anything else, it would show that we're taking that step, even though we're in this weed patch now, that someday we'll get out of this weed patch. And when we do, I think it will have been wise for us to be considering things like year-round education, full-day kindergarten, and excellence in education, because ultimately, almost all of the studies say that when it comes to economic development and getting out in front of this global competition we face, is a very solid, educated workforce is the best thing we can do long-term.
Thank you very much. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gilster. Senator Hass, years ago, some school districts had the 45-15 schedule for a full year school. And do you have any information about what happened to those? If they're
yes, I do.
Thank
that,
you.
That occurred in a couple of school districts, most notably Salem Kaiser, and there was some success there because there was they reduced this regression of summertime. And but what happened was, even though there was success and some improvement, the entire district was not on that format. And so you ran into some scheduling hassles if you do that modified track. And so that, you know, created some problems with sports. It created some problems with parents who had a high schooler in one school who wasn't on that, and a grade schooler who was. And so there was a couple of changes in administration, and ultimately somebody said, let's just slide everybody back over to one schedule system. Yeah. That's not what I'm interested in here, is the modified track where we still keep the same number of days and just kind of adjust the schedule, although there are some arguments for some limited success. This is adding days to the school year. We have one of the shortest school years in Oregon in the country, so we need to improve on that. But this looks down the road 10 or 20 years and says, you know, instead of 170 days, we should be doing 200 days. But let's start with some pilot projects. Let's see what mistakes we can avoid before we go full throttle, and let's see the smart way, figure out the smart way to do this.
Thank you. Is there a representative Fletcher?
pass it. I have to admit, I'm not familiar with, I wasn't involved with any previous hearing on this, so this is kind of, I guess it's surprising to me, because I remember attending summer school, because I was a nerd and I chose to, I didn't have to, and so I'm thinking you're thinking about something above and beyond remedial type education, or just, for the heck of it classes, you're talking about actual extending the school year into the summer.
Chair Gelsa, Representative Thatcher. Most school districts have some kind of program that is specialized for, I don't know if it's for nerds, but I don't think they call it that. But most programs allow kids who have fallen behind or struggled the year before to finish up the credits they need to pass on. Many school districts have that. I know Beaverton has that. I'm not talking about that. I am talking about something that is regular, okay. Regular schoolwork. And I think under some models, you know, that a full year of education may limit the K through 12 year to K-10. And then maybe we transition into college or technical training or whatever it is. I think that the value is there. The research is certainly there. And, you know, there's a reason that Germany, Japan, and now China and India go full year. And if that next generation is going to compete with those countries, I think, you know, education has to be first and foremost where we need to be looking at to try to get that workforce that will compete.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Senator Haas, just thank you for bringing this forward. It's something that I absolutely believe in as an educator and an administrator, that we had year-round school in Woodburn for a number of years, and it was because of constraints that we didn't have enough space. But what we found was just remarkable results about just overall adjustment of students. They were used to being in a certain schedule and continuing their education. As you said, the research is clear that the first month of school is kind of relearning from the previous year, and that did not happen. It was just a continuous engagement, and I like the idea of a pilot, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a proponent of year-round school. I think we're a long ways from there, quite frankly, and one of the greatest values that I see in the concept here is I think it's going to take us a long time to get people generally on board with the idea, and I think that this is a great opportunity to start inching maybe in that direction. I spent all last summer being a private tutor for my son, and it was amazing. Mm-hmm. It was worth so much more than just 3 months.
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, I could not agree more. I just think there is a big cultural divide that we have to inch toward, mm-hmm. to use your words. I mean, you know, my daughter, my 10-year-old, was telling me this. She said, Dad, if this becomes a law, I'll be the most hated kid in America. So we have to.
That's second to paying for tutoring.
I do believe this bill failed on the floor in the debate among the children.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, well. Yeah. It's like we already did that.
Are there any further questions? Senator Harker. Representative Parker.
Hey.
Sorry, Senator Haas.
Congratulations. Wishful thinking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the bill lets school districts seek funds, it requires them to report, but gives no money, correct?
Correct.
Requirement?
Yeah.
Without money, correct?
Yeah. It's like my
well, the
bill.
Department of Education, you may hear from on this, is enthusiastic about doing this. So
we'll hear from him now.
I don't have anybody else.
I do have a question for Morgan.
Maybe we'll hear from them. Or
we always want to hear from Morgan.
Yes.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and we did work closely with Senator Haas on these amendments and to eliminate the fiscal in our department. And I think the reporting that I believe you're discussing in force, I don't have a copy of the bill in front of me, would be if a district actually engaged in the pilot project, we would ask them to report back, probably as a condition of receiving the grant. So they would have resources ostensibly to do that if they were able to receive a grant. And I think, like many of our other bills, you know, this is dependent on if there is money available. You know, it's not going to happen if there aren't grants available, but I think there's a very high likelihood that there's going to be private and foundation money available to do this and that our school districts can get. So it should not be an undue burden on a school district or school, individual school, depending on how they do it.
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to qualify before I ask my question, this is an option for them to do this, and so they know that requirement, that reporting requirement. Correct me if I'm wrong, Morgan, but I'm envisioning, and I'm a big one that doesn't like the all of the reporting and the redundancy within the reporting. But I admit, I think Representative Parker brought up a great point, but as I look at this, I instantly went to, I guess in my head, thinking about a lot of those reports, this doesn't initially feel like a new and different report. It's just capturing information that is already captured for 3 months or 2 months.
Yeah,
additional.
Chair Gelser and Representative Springer, I'm just trying to refresh myself on the memory of what they have to report on, and I don't think it's anything new. And, I mean, we actually, let's see here.
Members of the committee, I think he's referring to subsection 4, just saying that
there we go
2010.
The actually, it's the department. That's right. We will be reporting on this. So essentially, I think what we would do, Representative Springer, is we would just, you know, let's say we had two school districts that did this, and, you know, they each had a school where they piloted this. I think what we would do is just ask them, basically tell us what happened. Tell us, you know, what you saw. We could compare test scores, you know, over a period of time, you know, student participation. It could be wide open. It could be anything that they want to tell us. So I don't think
they tell us what you did last time?
Yeah.
We already knew what you did last time.
So, you know, that the report, probably the way I'm reading the bill, and now that my memory is refreshed, is that we would actually probably be here. I can envision a panel where Senator Haas, the grantors and the grant recipients and the department are all up here sort of saying, hey, this is what happened. This is how much money we had. This is what we did at the individual schools or at the district level. These are some of the results that we saw. It's pretty wide open. So I would, you know, and I think to really get to Representative Parker's question, if you want the grant money, I think there would be an expectation that you need to tell us what you did with it and how it helped or how it changed your programs.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. And this is Morgan. This sounds very similar to what we're trying to do with our health literacy thing. We set up a fund to do whatever and get the money, and I want you to know that Pfizer gave $385,000 to New Mexico, so they're on our list.
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, as many members of this body know, the Senator and Representative Van Orman know, and Senator Morissette and many others, we have crafted many of these bills very carefully sort of in the fiscal environment so that a lot of folks are not going to be on the hook if there isn't money available. But I think that it's clear that there's going to be funds available for many of these things, and we'll be happy to work on those, and that is we can do that in our little tiny sponge, so we can absorb that.
May I?
Yes, of course.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Van Orman just sparked another question, and probably the language is in here and I missed it. I guess the first quick question is the grants would come into ODE. The private funding would come into ODE and grants would be through ODE?
No, Chair Gelser and Representative Springer, not necessarily. I believe the money could go directly to the school districts. We would establish a process by which that they could seek those. But it leaves it, if you look at subsection 3 on the first page, it really leaves it to the school districts to seek public and private funds for the purposes of. So there probably wouldn't be a middleman here. But I think our role in all of this is that of helping facilitate, sort of put an official stamp on it and make sure that it gets done.
Thank you. And I guess I just put this statement on the table as I just started thinking about this. I can see some districts, me being from geographically large district,
but not a particularly affluent district, I can see some of the school districts and bigger businesses really stepping up to the plate, which is a positive on this, and perhaps some of the districts, school districts across the state, struggling to garner those grant dollars and creating some interesting dynamics there within maybe state testing standards that are now maybe a little tweaked. Just a thought. Does that make sense to anybody? Almost looks like it doesn't. Okay.
Are there any further questions for Morgan or Senator Hass? Thank you both.
Thank you
very much. Is there anyone else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 484? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 484. Open a work session on Senate Bill 484.
Madam Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 484 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbro moves Senate Bill 484A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, would you please call the roll, Debbie?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Kopp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Yes.
Representative Roland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbro?
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes and moves to the floor. Who wants to carry this one? Representative Springer will carry. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Hass. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 484. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 64A. Morgan and Steve, please. To give me a quick rundown, and I have a quick question too. I'm wondering if we have back yet the before we get too deeply into the amendments. Do we, Chuck? Do we have all the amendments we need to this bill, for this bill yet? 64A.
Madam Chair, we've received a dash three amendment that I think literally came off the presses while you guys were on the floor today. It has been submitted to Fiscal and Revenue. We do not have either one of those documents back at this point, but we have raised, and that's the dash three, as I understand it, and it should be in your packets at the dais.
And is that the amendment? Okay. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is Senate Bill 64A, which clarifies the distribution expenditure of certain amounts of local revenues received by school districts of education service districts. It includes the 2008-2009 school year distribution of certain amounts of local revenue. It does declare an emergency. As we indicated, there is a dash 3 amendment. I have not had an opportunity to review that, but I understand that this is similar to what Mr. Bennett has submitted to the submitted. We do not have the fiscal or revenue, as I indicated previously, with respect to the amendment at this time.
And I think this actually is not the amendment that we are waiting for. We were waiting for something that talked about the student is a resident of the district in which their parent or guardian lives. And this does not have that language. So without that amendment, we're not going to be able to move this bill. But we can go ahead and have the hearing, but we're not going to move the bill until we have the appropriate amendment.
Okay. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. And we're here, there were several questions that related both to Senate Bill 64, the portion that Mr. Bennett was attempting to amend, and then Senate Bill 70. So we've distributed a three-page document to the committee that I believe we went back and tallied all the questions. There are some questions from Representative Comp, some questions from you, Madam Chair, and a few other members, and I think we've tried to sort of categorize them. There were questions around district residency for long-term care and treatment, questions around where does a parent go if they have concerns or questions about their kid while they're in a long-term care and treatment program or a hospital program, questions about assessments, questions about responsibility for IEPs and faith and all those types of things. Specifically to Senate Bill 64, on page 3 of this document, at the very top, the question I think that Mr. Bennett, and we heard from the superintendent from the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESC, the question or the issue they're trying to address, we answered this. The question was basically who's responsible for providing educational services to privately placed students who end up in a residential or day treatment, long-term care, and treatment facility. So in that situation, and I think, and Mr. Bennett can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the situation that superintendent was describing was and the vast majority of kids that end up in long-term care and treatment programs are placed there by the Oregon Youth Authority or the Department of Human Services or their designees due to a health issue or a mental health issue. And so the question is, what happens, let's say I'm a parent and I have a student in, and I live in Albany, and I have a high school student who has a mental health issue that I feel can only be addressed by them going to the children's farm home, for example. And so I basically pull them out of school and put them in a private placement at the children's farm home that was not made by a public agency. The Department of Human Services is not involved. This is just me as a parent exercising my right to get that student over there. I think the question comes down to who is responsible for providing that education. And I'll have Steve help me if I'm not explaining this correctly, but my understanding, based on what we discussed at the hearing last week and our research on this, is that nobody's obligated to provide that student services. They can't. The current statutes do not allow us to reimburse our providers from the state school fund for those services. And it's similar to, you know, if it's, you know, I guess you could look at it as sort of a similar to a situation if a parent decided to place their student in a private school. They've pulled them out of school and they've put them in this facility, and our current statutes and rules don't address allowing them to be paid for out of the state school fund for this, the long-term care treatment. I believe that's what Mr. Bennett is trying to correct with his amendment. So, and I hope I explained that right. And Steve, you can feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, because that is totally all right. I make lots of mistakes. So,
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Smith from the Oregon Department of Education, and that is the current interpretation of the statute for students that are placed by their parents or private insurance into facilities that provide long-term care and treatment.
So that's that question. And then Representative Comp had a question relating to long-term care treatment about the funding and reserves. And that's on the very bottom of page 3. Essentially, if you remember, and I might have to stop because I'm drifting into Senate Bill 70, so if you need me to stop and wait till that one comes up, I'd be happy. But essentially, if you remember, the underlying part of our long-term care treatment fix in Senate Bill 70 was we're trying to change the way we draw down money off of the state school fund to the way we've historically done it. The statute does not allow us to draw it off by ADM. We need to draw it off by the number of slots or beds that are available in these facilities, and ADM, as we talked about, gets us about $8 million short in the next biennium for that program. So in the current biennium, during the first year, we did it by slots, and then in the second year, we did it by ADM as the statute requires. We used $3.9 million of reserves.
Now we really are into that one. So I'm also opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 70A.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And then so essentially what we did to make up for that shortfall by drawing down the money correctly, as statute requires, we used $3.9 million of the money in those reserves to cover that. And that was for the long-term care and treatment programs. The ADM drawdown for the hospital programs was sufficient to meet the needs. So all of that reserve money went to just the long-term care and treatment programs. So, and then, Representative Comp, you had a follow-up question about how much money is still in reserves. And the answer to that question is during the legislative budget rebalance, I guess that would have been back in March, I believe we had about $3.8 million in that reserve fund. $2 million of that dollars was recaptured to help balance the budget in March. In the fund sweep. So there's about $1.8 million left in that fund, $200,000 in reserves for the hospital programs, and about $1.6 million for long-term care and treatment in emergency reserves or carryover. So we have gone down to that amount. That's what's currently available.
Thank you. Are there questions? No. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 70A or Senate Bill 64A today? Okay. Okay, before I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 64A, I'm holding this one over until Friday. The public hearing. And I'm closing the public hearing. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 64A. Closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 70A. Opening a work session on Senate Bill 64A. Holding that work session over until Friday. Closing the work session on Senate Bill 64A. Opening a work session on Senate Bill 70A. Representative Dimbrough.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 70A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbrough moves Senate Bill 70A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Crump.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I need to catch up. Can we have the staff give us an overview of 70A again?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, 70A specifies the amount of the school, state school fund that the Department of Education shall receive for institutions of certain hospitalized children and children in long-term care treatment. It does declare an emergency and is effective on July 1st. There's an amendment that modifies the formula for calculating the sum the Department of Education is going to be using to receive those state school funds, or receive from the state school fund.
And that's the A3, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Let's withdraw the. Yes. Madam Chair, I move to withdraw. Do we have to suspend the rules to withdraw?
I think you can just withdraw your own amendment.
Yes. Madam Chair, I withdraw my motion for Senate Bill 70A.
And before you make another motion, Representative Kahn.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I wanted to make sure that you got your summary.
I got the summary, yes. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, are you thinking of going directly to work this, pass this along?
Senate Bill 70? Yes. Yes, that is the plan for today. We're running out of days.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a problem?
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 70A, dated May 11th, 2009.
So Representative Dimbrough moves the -3 amendments to 70A. Is there any discussion? Representative Parker, do you have discussion on the amendment?
Not so much about the amendment as about the bill.
Okay. So is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Representative Dimbrough.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 70A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
So Representative
as amended.
Representative Dimbrough moves Senate Bill 70A to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Representative Parker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My problem with this bill doesn't have to do with the intent of the bill or the people that the bill is intended to assist as pupils or as education providers. It has to do with this formula, which is a god-awful mess, and I hate the notion of complicating it further, the distribution of funds in the state. And to me, this is a further complication of that formula, and as such, I'm inclined to vote against it because I would like to simplify it or radically redo it.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Kahn?
Thank you, Chair Gelser. My concern is very much a mirror of what Representative Parker is saying. The last bill that we sent to revenue about the formula was soundly defeated. I absolutely want to make sure that our children are taken care of. But once again, adjusting a formula out of context is very problematic for me.
Is there further discussion? Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I would say to the formula, having been around when the formula that we currently have was developed, and we think of making legislation as making sausage. The grinder in that particular negotiations was much, much more, how would I put it? It was a very heavy-duty grinder. And I agree that it would be nice to have some of those things changed, but I think that these children probably would have served out their lifetime before we... I'm just worried that if we don't do something to assure that we have the funds necessary for these kids to get the services they need, stopping it and then them not getting the services would be a rather big disservice. So although I think that it would be nice to have conversations around it, I believe that to be a Herculean task. And I've worked on some trying to get people together in the last in this session on bills, which I wasn't sure was possible, and we've had a couple really great successes. This is one I would not take on unless I was really had a lot of sleep and I was rested and, you know, feeling pretty good. So from my perspective, this is the best we can do at the moment to make sure that these students get the services they need. And I look forward to Representative Harkin and Representative Comp solving the other problems in the future.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. My question is to make sure that I understand what we're doing, because my perception is that we're going from a certain amount of money based on an average daily to a slot. And my understanding from my locals is that the slot for them is far better than what has been currently done, because they're seriously underfunded by the other method. And so I would support this simply because we're going to the slot method.
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, I think the key number here is that these programs, long-term care and treatment and hospital programs, if you remember, I had a one-pager spreadsheet that sort of showed the comparison. If we do not make this change to the formula, these programs will lose about 40% of their funding that we draw down off the state school fund, or over $8 million. And we feel like that's going to devastate the ability for our ESDs and our contractors and these programs to provide services to these kids.
And Morgan, to clarify, the reason that they would lose that money is that for whatever reason, the department had not understood the statute previously, yes, and the current practice had been what we are changing the law,
sure,
to, so that there's not a shift in practice from what's always been done.
Chair Gelser, that's correct. According to my research, talking to our staff, and I asked our staff to contact people that used to work at the department, for probably at least 15 years, we had been drawing this money down off the state school fund by slots. And during the current binding, we discovered that is not a correct interpretation of the statute. So we started doing it right. We did it right, and we used our reserves to make up the difference. And so what we're here asking today is that we essentially allow the practice that has gone on for probably 15 years, maybe more, because these programs have built their budgets and services over time based on an expected level of funding. And it's, you know, conceivable that they could make do with a little bit less, because everybody's going to have to make do with a little bit less during the next biennium, but not a 40% reduction because of the way the drawdown from the state school fund works. They will not be able to survive that, and it will seriously impact these programs. And I would just remind the committee, I've talked to, you know, OEA, COSA, OSB, and all our education friends, and I think everyone understands the urgency of this, because if these kids aren't served at these programs, they probably end up back at the school districts. And somebody's going to have to pay for them, probably, whether we're paying for them right now by changing the formula, or whether they end up back at their resident districts, or we have to do some sort of other private placement. Somebody's going to have to pay for them along the line.
Thank you. Is there further Representative Cobb?
Thank you, Chair.
One of these kids come.
I will be giving a courtesy yes to this, but I respectfully request that there's notes in our summary about the overall need to do some analysis. These programs are absolutely essential to our children. As a school administrator, we had children waiting 18 months to 2 years to get the appropriate services they deserved. And so, it's hard to penalize somebody for a philosophic or an urgency need in another analysis area. And that's certainly not my intent, because these are critical programs for these children.
Thank you, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would agree with Representative Comp, and I don't want to minimize the need for this, but I do agree that 2558 four small high schools, you know, we continually mess. Now, I don't know if I had called them slots on 2533 instead of remote and necessary, if I had said remote and necessary slots, I don't know if that would have helped me out or not, but I'm going to be a yes vote. I don't know if it's a courtesy yes or a full yes, but the formula does concern me, and I think we need to get that sausage grinder powered back up and get some work done here, because we are continuing to pick and choose what we're going to change the formula and funding on, and they're all necessary.
And I think what Representative Huffman is referring to, since not everyone spends 8 a.m. every day in Hearing Room A, this committee sent forward House Bill 2533, correct, from Representative Huffman, which was the remote and necessary, and that was Ways and Means had requested to have that, to start to have this discussion about formula change and other things. We also sent forward House Bill 2558, which had to do with the small high school formula. We heard 2558, and then in revenue we heard House Bill 2533, but then 2533 wasn't that remote and necessary bill anymore, and it's no longer going to Ways and Means, and it's now a combination of a portion of 2558 and the Portland gap bond authority. So I can appreciate Representative Huffman's dismay about his bill, which looks very different than when he authored it and sent it on.
We're partners.
Is he still the chief sponsor?
Are you still the chief sponsor of that bill?
No longer. I withdrew my name.
All right. Is there any further discussion on this particular bill itself? Seeing none, I do think that our school funding formula needs a lot of work. I think we need a lot of work in our process, because even when we ask these questions, there's a lot of debate and discussion. Where should that discussion happen? In the policy committee, in the Ed Sub of Ways and Means, or in revenue? So we have structural issues with the formula itself. We also have structural issues about how to have a discussion about it. And I think we really need to be tackling those issues. For today, for this, I think it raises the issue of how our formula works. In this case, I think it's in many ways a housekeeping fix because of how things have worked in the past. And we have to be providing education services to students that land in Shriners for a long period of time or Oregon Health Sciences University. So that is why we are moving the bill. Debbie, would you please call the roll? Oh, sorry.
Madam Chair, a question?
Yes, Representative Parker.
Representative Comp mentioned that we put a note in somewhere. I'm familiar with budget notes on my Ways and Means subcommittee. Right. I'm not sure familiar with them here on a policy committee.
We don't get policy notes, but we do get a staff measure summary.
Okay.
And so where it talks about what the committee discussed in discussing the bill.
Mm-hmm.
It would be cool if it out.
Especially asterisks on my notes.
And so did you put down that Representative Harker would love to chair the committee? On
She has a sharpening tool already.
Is there any further discussion? Okay, Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Harker?
For the above stated reasons, no.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Kahn?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Yes.
Representative
Roland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Okay.
I can vote twice.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbro?
Aye.
Chair Gelzer?
Aye. Having received the required votes, the bill passes. Representative Kump, would you like to carry this bill on the floor so that you can also raise the issue of the need to do the...
Or answer the question if Representative Harper
Chair Gelzer, at your discretion, yes.
Request unanimous consent to suspend the rules and allow Representative Harker to change his vote.
No. This can't be put on the consent calendar. Oh, hey, we had a vote.
No, we're not going on.
We're not going on that. You don't have to if you don't want to. Okay, great. Thank you. So close the work session on Senate Bill 70. So we have completed all of our work for today. We have two more meetings in which to process Senate bills. We have how many bills on our agenda for Friday?
I think we are still at 9 because 64 had been previously left on for the administrator's clairvoyance decided that maybe that was not going to be finished today, but inadvertently left on. So I think we have 9 plus, I think there are 2 that we've carried over.
Okay. So we have 9 bills for Friday. We have several for Wednesday, which is our last day. The other thing we have on our agenda for next Wednesday is to discuss our work plan for the interim. So if you want to start thinking about what you would like to be tackling during our interim, we can start having that discussion next week as well. You want to tackle Representative Harker in the
His concern about funding for it.
We just have him do it, and then we come back.
All right. Is there anything else for the good of the order?
Madam, when did we carry over 64A to Friday or Wednesday?
Friday. Seeing nothing, the House Committee on Education is adjourned. And Representative Harker and Representative